Welcome to The Labyrinth. The Labyrinth is a show dedicated to finding the strange and the unusual in our world. My name is Cesar Torres, and each week I bring you a guest who will tell you his or her story. At the end of each show, I will ask, what is the strangest thing that has ever happened to you? Welcome back to The Labyrinth. In episode 29, William Shun joins me in the virtual studio. Bill, as I call him, is the author of several short stories and novellas, as well as some upcoming fiction and nonfiction book-length works. You can find Bill in a couple of different ways, of course, online. But what's interesting is that you'll hear about Tuesday Funk, which is a literary reading series that happens in Chicago. So if you are ever interested in seeing writers in person read their own work, that section of the podcast I think should be pretty interesting. We also cover a lot of talk about process and what it means to write and call oneself a writer. As always, your reviews are really essential. If you go to the iTunes store and you love or hate the show, please leave us a review or a star rating. The star rating takes no time. You just click once. And that will help us become more visible. We are on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, we are LabyrinthCast. On Facebook, if you just go to the search, you can search for Labyrinth Podcast. We are there. And you can also email us at labyrinthcast, labyrinthcast, at gmail.com. I have a bit of news for you, which is that I am looking to basically reformat parts of the show. And I know I talked a lot about continuing the interviews week by week, so that I end up with 52 interviews in the course of a year. There still is no change to that. But don't be surprised if in the next few weeks I start experimenting more with bringing some guests back. So I think to be fair, I'd like to make sure that if we're going to count the new interviews towards the 52, I think that we should stick with that. And if I bring back recurring guests, then that is just sort of an additional bonus that you get in the feed. And we may just cover other topics. What they are, I don't know. They'll probably be based around the stories of people's lives, which is one of the things I love about this show. So look for that in the feed. I don't have any details as to who is coming back or when. So that should be exciting. That's something to look forward to. And in the meantime, you can still continue to expect new people showing up in the interviews, leading all the way up to 52. So we've got about under two dozen left, and I'm very excited about that. And I can tell you, even going into a second year, I don't think I'll necessarily be dropping that. I think it's really important to bring in new people into the show, but I'm really considering kind of lots of things in year two of The Labyrinth. So maybe it's time to add a little video, or maybe it's time to maybe focus some of the topics in some way. I don't know yet, but I think experimenting is essential, and that's one of the cool things about podcasting, right? There's no rule or anything saying that I have to stick to it in a certain way. So bringing some guests back will be cool. If you have any additional ideas, let us know what you'd like to see here, what guests you've really loved. I got some really great feedback recently about the interview with Bob Curran. And if you want to listen to that, that's episode 28. And again, if you really, really like a certain guest or something that we're doing here, let us know, because we will bring back a lot more of that for you. And at the same time, we'll experiment and push the limits further in other dimensions of the show. So I want to hear from you, our listener. And now let's move on to the interview. Welcome to The Labyrinth.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for Thanks for being here in the virtual studio. I'm going to call you Bill because we're actually friends, and it sounds a little artificial to call you William. But for the sake of the listeners, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I'm a science fiction writer. I started publishing short fiction about 20 years ago. I made my first sale in 1992 to the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Since then, I've published about 30 works of short fiction. I've been nominated for the Nebula Award twice, once for the Hugo Award. In 2009, Daryl Murphy and I published a short horror novel that we collaborated on called Cast a Cold Eye. That came out from PS Publishing in 2009. But I've really spent most of my writing career avoiding writing book-length works of any kind, although I've been trying to change that the last few years. I've just finished a novel, a young adult science fiction novel called Waking Vishnu. And my other big project has been a memoir called The Accidental Terrorist, which is about my time as a Mormon missionary.
So there's a lot of places to begin here, Bill, but we're going to go from the beginning.
Okay.
You know, you said your body of work, especially up front, was short stories. What drew you to that form, and how did you do it when you got started?
Well, my entrance into trying to become published was back when I was 15 years old. I'd been trying to write science fiction stories, novels, up to that point. I'd always wanted to be a writer. But that's when my dad brought home a copy of Asimov's Science Fiction magazine for me, because he'd heard from one of the other teachers at the school where he taught that this was a place where people could sell science fiction stories. So at that point, I really started concentrating on trying to sell short stories. That brought me to the Clarion Workshop in 1985 when I was 17. That was a six-week workshop at Michigan State University that was taught by, as some of your listeners may know, it's taught by six professional science fiction writers who each take a week. And that really gave me a very good grounding in how to write and approach publishing short fiction. And the conventional wisdom at the time, which maybe wasn't even true then, but certainly isn't as true now as it used to be, was that publishing short fiction was how you made a name for yourself in the science fiction field. And that would eventually lead to writing novels. And that was pretty much the career path that you took back in those days. So after Clarion, it took me several years, 6 or 7 years before I started actually selling my short stories, and almost immediately I started working on a novel back then. I wrote my first novel in about 8 weeks because I'd just gotten laid off from my job. I wrote incredibly fast, faster than I'd ever written in my life. And of course, the novel was terrible. It never sold. And it just became easier as I had jobs and so forth to concentrate on short fiction, because that was what I had time to write.
When you got started out, and especially post Clarion, were you writing the kind of stuff that we know you for, which would be science fiction and fantasy, or did you try other genres?
I tried other genres a little bit, but mostly it was science fiction and fantasy. That was what I really read. I actually read widely. I read a lot of genre fiction, mostly not so much mainstream fiction, except for the classics you had to read in school. But I read science fiction, fantasy, crime novels, mysteries, techno thrillers, all kinds of genre stuff. But science fiction was the stuff I really loved, because that was what really turned me on to reading in the first place. I had discovered Isaac Asimov when I was in junior high school, and I'd always wanted to write, but as soon as I read Reason, a short story by Asimov, I knew I wanted to write that kind of stuff.
That's cool. Tell me about the role that reading played growing up for you, knowing what we know about having grown up in a Mormon environment.
Yeah. Reading was very important to me from a really young age. Actually, my dad was a teacher. My mom had not ever really taught, but she had a teaching degree also. And my mom would read to me always from the time I was before I could read. And I actually learned to read around the age of 3, and I was reading stuff on my own at that point. And so I've just really been absorbed in fiction, in reading, in books, my whole life. And education is one of the values that Mormon families place very highly. And you know, I'm no longer a practicing Mormon, but those values were instilled in me really young. That learning was important. Improving yourself was important. Reading was a huge part of that. Even if, you know, later on, my father really did not approve of a lot of the things I started reading.
Yeah, did he ever get a chance to read them, or did he find out after they were published?
No, he was pretty well involved with helping me find places to publish. Because he wanted to, he was conflicted. I mean, on the one hand, I was reading this weird science fiction, and he didn't really approve of that. In fact, he told me a couple of times that I was forbidden to read science fiction because it seemed like the stuff I was reading was about topics that might seem to be in conflict with our religion, like cloning, all kinds of things like that. But I kept reading it anyway, and as I was writing science fiction, I didn't hide everything that I was working on, but I certainly didn't let my parents read everything I was writing. But by the time I was good enough to start getting stuff published, I was a lot less embarrassed about letting them see what I was writing, and it wasn't really material at that point that was. That I'd consider controversial to my family or my religion. I did more of that later.
And you know, the time has passed, and I'm curious, do they now think of you as a writer? You know, like every family sort of says, "Oh, my son or daughter is a physician or a you know, would a cabinet maker, but is the writing label something that has emerged in your family?
I think so, yeah. My dad passed away about 5 years ago, but he knew that that was the thing I did. He considered me a writer. He bragged about me to, you know, random strangers on the street. It was not something that he ever thought I should be full-time, though. He really wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer or... You know, failing that, some kind of. I went into computer programming, and he would have been happiest if I had, you know, picked a steady career, a steady job, and stuck to it, and just did writing on the side, rather than, as he put it once, letting the whole writing thing take over my personality.
Oh, interesting. And tell me about that. Do you feel like your personality and is taken over by writing? I mean, I can answer that question as your friend, mm-hmm. but I think it's really important to hear from you. You know, how do you think about yourself?
Yeah, a writer is the thing I think about myself. That's the way I think of myself the most. You know, I've done tons of other things. I didn't always want to be a computer programmer growing up. I didn't even know I could do that. And so I consider myself a programmer as well. But writing is definitely the number one thing, the main thing. And I'm actually fortunate enough to be in a place in my life where I can do that as my main thing and maybe do a little freelance computer programming once in a while. But that is how I think of myself.
And, you know, at the bottom of the show, or actually it was the top, so we'll have to edit this. Whoops. At the top of the show, you you mentioned that you, quote-unquote, avoided writing a novel-length work for a while. I have the suspicion that, of course, you're being ironic about that, but that at some point things changed, and yeah, something bigger was coming together here. Tell me what allowed you to make the transition from having written and published short stuff into actually taking on a novel.
Well, I'm pretty serious actually about the fact that I was avoiding writing a novel. I wanted to be a novelist. I mean, that's the thing. You don't really grow up thinking I'm going to be a short story writer. Although there are people who make a career out of just writing short fiction. But I wanted to write books. I wanted to write big, honking, you know, science fiction epics. And things that would you know, make the world sit up and take notice and make my name a household word or whatever. That was always what I had in mind. I think as I got farther into my short fiction career, and especially having had that first novel just go nowhere, I became kind of honestly afraid to write a novel. I think I was afraid of, you know, succeeding in some ways, and I you know, I'm still working on some of these issues, but I find really good ways to sabotage myself, and I always feel like I could be doing more and better writing than I've been doing. I just need to. I'm often not as disciplined as I'd like to be, and so I really was. Just putting off the time that I would start writing a novel because I was afraid to get started on it. Part of what helped with that was this memoir that I actually started writing in 1999 about my experiences as a missionary. And that project dragged on and on and on through various drafts. I think I'm up to about draft number 10 right now. But the fact that I was actually able to, that I was prompted by an agent to start writing this memoir because I had pitched the idea to her, and when I actually started, I discovered that if I just sat down and concentrated and did a little bit every day or every week, I actually could write a 200,000 page book, and that sort of, obviously I don't want to spend 10 years writing every book that I'm working on, but that did at least give me the confidence that I could sit down and try to do the same thing with fiction.
Yeah, that's something I've noticed sort of comes up a lot in talking to other writers. It's there's a bit of conquering this fear of succeeding, and I think, you know, I want to clarify for people listening, success isn't always equated with my book is out or it's a bestseller. Sometimes it's just succeeding in writing the stuff and being honest with yourself about it. And I don't know that what you say there, so it rings so true about, especially the novel. I mean, I think before you ever finish one, it seems like the most impossible task in the world.
Yes, it does. And even when you've finished one and you're starting to think about writing another one, it again seems like the most impossible task in the world. Sometimes it always takes me quite a while to work my way back into getting started on a project that big.
Yeah, and once you completed the novel, so you did you went through the memoir first, then you did the novel. Yeah, I'm curious about your process. You know, tell me about some of that.
The process has been similar with both the memoir and this novel, Waking Vishnu. I have the basic idea, and I know kind of where I want to start. And before I start the project, I really need to know where it's going to end. I mean, it might seem like it's obvious how the story of a memoir is going to go because it's my life and my experiences I'm writing about. But it's still a case where you have to take a whole heap of scenes that you might want to put into a book, a bunch of different things that either happened to me or that I'm imagining are going to happen to these characters, and really trying to decide which ones are important to the story, where the best place to start is, and where the best place to end is. And it's not always obvious from the start, but I do try to construct a list or a deck of scenes that I'm going to put in the book. I try to find a good order to put them in, because even with the memoir, I don't necessarily tell all the events in chronological order. I try to put them in an order that's going to make the most sense for the story. And so I've got kind of this very loose outline before I start writing. And then I just go, and I feel free to take whatever tangents along the way seem to crop up. You know, if the story seems to want to take a left turn as I'm writing the novel, I go with it. And if that seems to fit, then it works.
You know, your memoir, in the way that you wrote it, is about a place. And for people that know you in Chicago as well, you have a particular passion for place as well. I want to mention here the Tuesday Funk literary readings that happen once a month. You are one of the co-hosts for that. And not only do you do that, but you're active in places like Twitter and other social media where people get a real sense of a place through you. So you've not only written about it, but you also sort of live it out. You know, there's so many Chicago spots that I sort of visualize through the photographs you take and the tweets that you send out. As you write a novel or short stories, you know, we can expand this. You know, what's the importance of place for you as you've written your fiction?
Place is a really, really important part of it. When I was early on in my career, when I was writing short stories, I'd often, and when my short stories weren't really seeming to succeed, I was often setting them in some kind of nebulous suburban wasteland without a real strong sense of place. It could have been anywhere. And I think that if you don't give a strong sense of place, you don't have the right kind of grounding for the story. Instead of you might think that if the setting is kind of vague, then it could be just about anywhere, and it could be generalized to make it relatable to any reader. But I really find it's just the opposite. When you ground a story in a lot of good physical detail about the place, about the time, that gives it specificity that allows people to relate to it better. And I'm in love with a lot of the places that that I've visited and that I've lived. I've tried to write stories, published stories that are set in New York in the neighborhoods where I lived. I published a story set in Los Angeles about three decades in the future, and LA was the place where I was born and where I visited a lot. So I always had a very strong desire to write something that was set there that would kind of evoke the same kind of place that I knew when I was a really small child. And with the novel Waking Vishnu, I actually set almost all of the action in my neighborhood here in Chicago, because I could just walk around and picture all the places where my characters were going to be interacting and running for their lives, and it really helped me picture the action better. And hopefully that will mean that the readers will get a better sense of the whole place that the characters come from.
You know, you've got that novel written, and you're always working on multiple projects. I haven't actually known you to just work on one single thing.
That's true.
What do you have? Do you have another sort of novel in the works? What do things look like as you have this one and that one's going out into the marketplace?
Right. Well, I've actually, during the course of writing Waking Vishnu, I was also working on a couple of drafts of the memoir. So those two things were going at the same time. I kind of alternated. I would finish one draft of the novel, then I did another draft of the memoir, and so on and so forth, until now they're both done. And hopefully they're about to be, my agent's about to send them out. But I've also got various short stories in different stages of completion, and I've got another novel that's taking shape in my head, which is a crime novel that will also be set in Chicago, And it's going to take place in the world of illegal dogfighting. So that's something I'm just starting to think about. I've started plotting it out. I've been keeping my eye out for interesting locations as I'm walking around with my dog and sort of beginning to picture that story. But I'm sure that that in between drafts of that, or even maybe between chapters, I will be working on other things, because that's the way I always seem to do it.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think for anybody, just having one single thing all the time, I don't know. I don't know what that's like. Let's say that. Now, let's go back to Tuesday Funk. You've been hosting that for a little while. Tell us a bit about it. We've got some listeners, obviously, who aren't from Chicago, and it's really, really cool. That's, in a way, the way I met you. So.
That's true. We met because you applied to be a reader at Tuesday Funk.
Yes.
and we had you read, and it was fantastic, and you've been back a couple of other times. Tuesday Funk is a reading series that was founded about 5 years ago by a guy named Connor Coyne, who's also a writer. He and a few friends had developed this kind of artistic collective called the Gothic Funk Nation, and they would throw Gothic Funk parties. And honestly, I was not around during that era, and I don't know what these parties were all about. But they were also publishing a an amateur literature journal, and they started this reading series to give them and their friends and other writers a chance to be part of the whole Gothic Funk experience. And that's why it's called Tuesday Funk. It was Gothic Funk readings on a Tuesday night, and they did it once a month. And through some connections of mine at the Writer's Workspace, which is a place in Chicago where I do a lot of my writing, essentially rent a cubicle at this place so I can have a quiet place free of distractions to write. A woman I met there was one of the hosts of Tuesday Funk. Her name was Hallie Palladino. She invited me to read. It was fun. They liked me. I came back and read maybe 4 or 5 more times. And then when two of the hosts essentially were simultaneously either moving or having kids, they asked me if I would be interested in being one of the new hosts. And I took a while to think about it, because I knew that running a reading series would be a whole lot of work and would take up a whole lot of time. And it does, but I ultimately decided that I'd probably kick myself if I passed up the chance to take over the series. So I took over as one of the co-producers about 2.5 years ago. And the series has been going strong ever since. We have it on the first Tuesday of the month at a bar called Hop Leaf at Foster and Clark in Chicago. There's a lovely upstairs room. And we've kind of shaken up the format from the days before I took over. We now feature 5 writers every month. Everyone reads for about 12 minutes. There's an intermission in the middle. After intermission, I always read a poem. And there's a private bartender right there. We've got everything we need right there in the room to have a fun reading. And it's usually a really, really fun night. And the great thing about it is, if you don't like one of the readers, just wait 10 minutes and someone else will be reading.
Which is true. Now, I want to talk about this, because one of the things I like about this particular format is that, you know, you get a good sampling. And I've been to a few readings in my time in life, you know, as far back as college, and sometimes they can be very painful events. And I like formats. I like making sure that the audience has a good time. And one of the things I will note about this, especially for people who go check it out, is that there is a focus on being mindful of the audience, that audiences expect some satisfaction in the story or the way that they're seated and what's happening. And so it's really, really fun. You go and you have a few beers there. The Hop Leaf is known for its extensive selection of beers. And I think intermission is fantastic. I think it's often underestimated how much people need a break. And then, yeah, it's pretty cool. I also think the format, though one would think that by bringing in a host that works in speculative fiction, that it would suddenly turn into speculative fiction night. It's not always the case. There's been some theme nights, right, where it's you've had speculative fiction writers like a night devoted to that. But what I really like about Tuesday Funk is that you get a little bit of everything. There's nonfiction, there's poetry, and I've met some really cool people there.
Yeah, yeah. There's just a great audience that comes out every month. And you see there's new people in the audience every month, and there are regulars who seem to always be there. The old standbys, I think of them, although I try not to take them for granted. It's interesting because having taken the reading series over from some other people, this kind of eclectic format was already established to some extent, and I really didn't want to mess with that. I mean, if I had been creating a reading series from scratch, I probably would have made it focus on science fiction and fantasy, horror, because those are the genres that, you know, where I have the most contacts and know the most people. But because the format was pre-existing, I really didn't want to mess with that and turn it into only science fiction night. And I think that as the series has evolved, it's come to reflect one of the things I appreciate most about Chicago and the literary scene here, which is that the borders between all the various different types of writing, all the genres, all the schools of writing, as it were, seem to be a lot more porous here than they were in New York City, where I lived for 12 years. I've been in Chicago for 5. And in New York, it seemed like it was very hard to break out of your little genre, your little clique, and get noticed by, say, the mainstream literary community. One thing I never did in New York was go to a poetry reading. And we have poetry, fiction, essays, the whole smorgasbord of different genres of literature at Tuesday Funk, and it seems to all work fine side by side, kind of in a way it does at other literary series in Chicago. I've had the chance to read at a few other series in Chicago, including Essay Fiesta. I'm going to be reading at Write Club, Ian Belknap's awesome reading series in April. And so I just love the way that these boundaries don't seem to be so hard and fast in Chicago, and everyone can seem to get along. And Tuesday Funk tries to reflect that.
I like it because I have yet to meet a single person who ever just only reads in one genre as part of their reading habits. So to me, Tuesday Funk reflects something that's more pleasing to people who, you know, one day you read a nonfiction book, or maybe you read a science fiction alongside something else. It's pretty cool that way. Now, you've mentioned so often in your descriptions of this how you've interacted with writers and audiences, and you're great at the poetry that you read because it's usually very funny stuff that you read. Not always, but it's sometimes it's a little bit more emotional and sad, but. You have a skill for basically finding community, especially when it comes to writers. You know, knowing how much the internet is out there and how well people connect with social media, what do you think is the importance of community for writers, especially today, like if they're trying to get published or get better at it?
I think community is everything when you're trying to learn how to get published and trying to continue to be published. There's really no such thing as a writer who develops in a vacuum. Well, it may happen in a few cases, but nobody does it in a vacuum, because in order to write, you have to be taking in different kinds of other people's writing. You kind of need something to react to. And as you're learning to write, you really need to get feedback from people who are going to be honest with you. People who are maybe not necessarily at your level, but a little ahead and a little behind, so that so that you can get guidance about what works in your fiction and what doesn't. And the other thing is, writing is such a lonely pastime, and it's something that people who don't do it really don't understand. You know, my wife understands that she doesn't know what it's really like to be a writer. She knows that I need time by myself, but she can't really relate to the process itself. You have to get together with other writers to be able to talk about the process, and just to be able to find other people who understand exactly what it's like to sit in a chair and rack your brain trying to get some sentences down on paper. It's just you really need the support of other people who are trying to do that same thing. And as you get farther along in your career, it's critical to be able to make all those networking connections. The reason I have the agent that I do right now is because I was going to science fiction reading series in New York, met someone else who was interested in or who was knowledgeable about science fiction. We'd run into each other at events and we became friends, and now he's my agent.
You know, you have a lot of insight into the community part, also the publishing piece on, you know, entering the marketplace. So for younger people, younger listeners, or people who are trying to get their writing going, what's your advice on, you know, how much of a body of work do they need to have to start showing it to somebody to A, get published, or like you did, you know, get an agent?
I think you need to have spent probably at least a couple of years writing. I mean, this probably doesn't apply to everybody. I have friends who sat down and decided they were going to write a story and popped one out and put it in the mail and they sold it. And I hate those people.
Who are these people?
Yeah, it was an ex-girlfriend of mine.
Oh, even worse.
Yeah. But no, you need to have honed your craft at least to some extent. You're not really going to get anywhere in the writing world if your writing does not look like there's some practice and some polish to it. Now that's to get published. I don't know that if you're coming into a workshop or a classroom situation, you need to have necessarily written your, you know, million words of fiction already that supposedly you have to produce before you can be published. But you do have to have sat down and actually tried to write a few stories before you go into a situation like that, because otherwise you just don't have the tools that that you don't really have a basis for understanding the tools that are going to be presented to you in the class. It's a little bit of a paradoxical situation, but this is one of the instances where you should try it and have some practice before you start showing it around. And one of the reasons for that is because you need to be able to have a little bit of distance from your own work if you're going to get if you're going to start getting critical responses to it. This is why it's important not to just show your writing to your significant other or to your mom or, you know, to your priest or whatever, because they want to please you, and they want to encourage you, but they also probably don't have the critical knowledge that you're going to need if you're going to improve. And that's going to require you being able to hear some other writers, probably a little more advanced than your level, telling you what's wrong with your stories, or at least places where they see it as deficient. And, you know, if this is the only thing you've written and your heart and soul has been poured into it, which it really should be for everything you write, you probably aren't going to have the distance from your work to not take the criticism personally. And I think at the wrong stage, it can probably actually be harmful to be getting the kind of criticism that you need. So put in some practice first.
No, that's sound advice. Do you ever think about teaching writing somewhere down the road?
I've thought about it, and there I may have an opportunity sometime in the next year to do a short series of workshops. I'm not sure about that. It might be in conjunction with the Chicago Writers Conference. It may happen. It may not. But yeah, I think about it, and to me, writing or teaching writing is kind of a terrifying prospect because, you know, I don't feel like I know enough or know everything I need to know to be able to guide a class full of people in you know, telling them what they need to be doing. I don't really feel like I have the academic background to be able to do that, but I'm also not sure that that's really necessary. I was just at a lecture, an interview with George Saunders, the short story writer, the other night, and he talked about how he'd had this whole career as a mining engineer while he was selling short stories, and then got a job teaching at Syracuse University, and he didn't know what he was doing as he came in and himself was kind of terrified about that, even as such an accomplished writer as he was. So, you know, I think I could probably do it in that situation, but I'd be terrified going into it.
Which sounds to me exactly why I should do it. The scariest things are the ones we should try, basically.
Probably.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I also want to mention to the listeners, because I think it presents a almost three-dimensional view of who Bill is, you know, when I was living in Chicago, we spent a lot of time together. As we mentioned before, I read at Tuesday Funk, and then through someone else we've had on the show, Eden Robbins, the writing group, writing club, as we called it, that we're a part of, came together, and I still communicate and participate electronically. So I submit my work and then they Skype me in. So it's very futuristic, although it's not as glamorous as you would think.
It's funny though, because you sit down there at the end of the table on a laptop screen, and it's like it's kind of like you're at the table with us.
It's really weird. It's like the Jetsons. And I do recommend this for some other groups. I mean, I don't think it could have worked if I didn't know you and have physical experiences like in the same room with you guys before. But who's to say, maybe in other groups, you know, you can completely do this online. There's so many workshops and groups that do this virtually all the time. I'm sure it could work. But in our case, as I came to New York and as I stayed here, I thought, well, this is, as long as I'm here, I want to hold on to that particular experience and meeting every 2 weeks. So it's been really, really cool. But Bill, is it fair to say that you're sort of our leader in that group, because you organize the space, you set up the listserv that we use to submit our work. It sounds like you're really in charge of a lot of stuff. You do Tuesday Funk. Have you always been kind of a person in charge?
I guess so. Maybe because I'm the oldest of eight children, and I had to do a lot of things like that, although I didn't really want to. but I think that role of kind of being leader of the writing group sort of somehow fell on me naturally. Eden was actually the founder of the group. It was her idea to put it all together. But you know, she was out of the country for about 6 months, and I had a lot more workshop experience than anybody else who was in the group at that time. So I guess it just kind of became natural that the things I'd done before were things that I wanted to suggest trying. So I never really think of myself as the leader of the group, but I am aware that I'm probably looked at that way to some extent.
Yeah, it's sort of an informal role that I definitely, for myself, I feel. I can't speak for anyone else. By the way, for any of you who are completists, if you want to go back through the episodes of this particular show and see who all else is in that group, we've also had Holly McDowell, who's part of that same group. So it's no big secret. And Eden, Holly, and Bill have been on the show. And if you would so like, I can bring on the other two members who would be more than happy to talk about their writing life. Bill, you know, do you think Chicago has a particular place in writing right now? I mean, there's so many cities that have these long traditions, just like Chicago, of generating all these writers. But you really talk to a lot of people. To me, it seems like there is a great era happening right now in Chicago writing. What do you think about that?
I kind of see the fringes of what's going on in the Chicago writing community because I don't get out to as many of the other reading series all the time as I would like to, and I don't read enough of the fiction that's specifically coming out of Chicago. But I do have the sense that one, there's a revolution in live literature going on here. There's just been an explosion of reading series coming out in the last few years.
Yeah.
I think Mare Swallow did a count, and there were something like 50 regular reading series going on in the city. And you know, people are always writing to me at Tuesday Funk asking to be included. But beyond that, just right in our very own neighborhood here on the north side of Chicago, there are some, you know, who people I'd term important writers working right around here. Alexander Haymon, who recently received a MacArthur Genius Grant, works at the Writer's Workspace, same as I do, and he writes regularly for The New Yorker. He just edited a volume of the year's best European fiction. Alex Shakar is in the neighborhood. He works at the Workspace also. He just won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for fiction for his novel Luminarium. There's just tons of really exciting writers in Chicago, and I do think there's something going on here right now. Even if I can't put my finger on it and say exactly what it is, this is definitely a great literary city.
You know, the one thing too, I sometimes get the question of, you know, what's the scene like? Or especially from people who aren't writers themselves. And sometimes people ask me about the readings and all the things that are happening as if I might have unlimited time to attend every single one of them and be involved. And so I feel kind of similar. To me, it's a hunch. It's sort of what I observe. And I think there is a really interesting and amazing thing happening in Chicago in particular. But for anybody who is a writer, your time gets whittled down so fast. It doesn't leave a lot of room for a lot of readings that you'd be surprised. And I think this is probably true of maybe people who work in the arts as performers, like actors and musicians will tell you, you know, they don't get to see every show that's out there,
right,
although they would like to. But I do recommend for any of our listeners who are just curious about that side of Chicago literary life to connect with him, because he's very, very available, and we'll talk about places to reach out to him at the end of the show. Bill, now you've heard me ask time and time again, but now I'm curious, because I can't actually predict what you might say. What is the strangest thing that ever happened to you?
Well, you know, I do listen to your podcast, and so I've been thinking about this for a while, and I was thinking, if I was ever on, what is it I was going to say? And you know, I could talk about the whole experience that went into the memoir that I've written, The Accidental Terrorist, which is all about how when I was a missionary, I got arrested for hijacking in Canada and went to jail briefly. And it's all true. I can never go to Canada again. but I don't feel like that's something strange that happened to me. I feel like that's something strange that I did. So I came up with I remembered another event from when I was a missionary. And mind you, I don't believe in the Mormon Church anymore. I drifted away from it in adulthood and really came to have opposing viewpoints, and I call myself much more of an atheist these days. But I had a really strange spiritual experience, and that's what I still think of it as. When I was a missionary, I was in northern Idaho at the time, and my partner and I were teaching a really old Jewish woman. She'd actually been born in Russia before the revolution. She was 91 years old. Her daughter had joined the Mormon Church and wanted her mother to be a member also, even though her mother was Jewish. And so we're teaching this old woman at the rest home a couple of times a week, teaching her about the Mormon Church. And she had all these ailments. She was often in pain. She had horrible arthritis. Often before our lessons, when we'd sit down with her, she would ask us to give her a blessing. And supposedly we had the power from the Mormon priesthood to give blessings, to heal the sick, to do all kinds of things like that, give people comfort. And so we would, my partner and I would take turns giving her a blessing so that she would be calm during our lessons. This one day, we got there, and the old woman was just so distraught because she was in so much pain. She was practically crying, and she said, "You know, can you please give me a blessing before we get started? Because I'm just in too much pain to even listen." And she was just in a real state. And my partner and I kind of looked at each other, and it's like, "All right, who gets to do the blessing this time?" Neither one of us really wanted to. But I ended up doing it. I put my hands on her head like we were supposed to. And as I was getting ready to just say the normal thing I would say, which was, you know, "We bless you that your pain will go away," or what or whatever, I actually found I couldn't speak at all. Until I decided, yeah, that I was going to say to her, "Minnie, you just are basically not going to, your suffering is not going to be relieved until the day when you leave this life and join your Father in heaven. And we don't know why this is, but, you know, this is part of your burden to share." And it was just like the creepiest thing that ever happened to me. But she, and just bizarre, but she settled down after that and was fine through the rest of that lesson. And, you know, to this day, I have theories for, you know, what happened, but I can't really explain it.
Oh, well, can you share one of your theories?
Yeah, my theory from today is that I just, you know, my mind just could not deal with the fact that she was in so much pain, and that I had to try to tell her again that she was going to be okay. And I just, maybe inside, I just felt like I could not keep lying to her and to myself and say that things were going to be okay. Wow. And so, yeah, I feel like maybe it was a case of my mind just totally rebelling from what I was trying to make it do.
How old were you at the time?
I was around that time, I would have been almost 20.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's pretty cool. Well, you know, I'm glad you held off on the other one. Because really, one day, once your book is out, once your memoir is out there, we're going to have one special show where you just come and talk about the memoir. So we'll save it for then.
I'll look forward to that.
Bill, how can people find you?
Several different ways. I have a personal website about me and my writing, my blog, at shun.net. That's shunn.net. And you can also connect with the Tuesday Funk reading series, where we have not just postings about our upcoming readings, but we actually post video from previous readings at tuesdayfunk.org.
And when is the next Tuesday Funk?
The next one, let me look at my calendar. That will be Tuesday, February 5th. It's 7:30 p.m. upstairs at Hopleaf. And our readings are always free, but they're also 21 and over only.
Which makes it even more exciting. Sorry, 18-year-olds.
Yes. And this next reading series is probably going to be a little more adult-themed than usual, in fact, because it's a themed night, and we're calling it Not Your Parents' Valentine's Day.
I want to be there. And I think I will definitely be here in New York. But as Bill noted, the video clips often get posted right away, so you can look for those and see what you missed. But the experience itself is completely worth it. It's very, if you are visiting Chicago, or if you're in Chicago and you're sort of saying to yourself, like, why don't I do more cool stuff in the city? That is definitely one thing that is easy to do. It's free. You just go and pay yourself with some beer, and the applause that you give to the readers is really what you need. You're there to participate with everybody. So I highly recommend it. And you can shake Bill's hand if you go there in person.
Yeah, if you do, please come say hello to me.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Bill, for hanging out with me. And I hope to bring you back in the future.
I hope to be back. And thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.